Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi there, Diane. How are you?
I am well. How's Greg?
I'm riding enough, but not often enough.
Okay, you need to quit your day job. That makes perfect sense to me.
Life is intruding,
it
as
is.
They say.
I know, and we are having such spectacularly gorgeous weather.
Yeah, but my backyard doesn't look like the savanna anymore.
Oh, well, that's good.
So,
did you have to take like a scythe? And,
practically.
You know, yeah, I know that feeling.
Practically.
I know. It's amazing. We're cutting the grass early and often.
Oh, yeah. It's not even Memorial Day.
Nope, it's not.
But that's coming up.
Very soon.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
So what's happening?
Well, it's pretty inescapable that it's also National Bike Month. Do you notice? Like, it's everywhere.
Yes, it is.
Yes. I don't see every other post is either let's ride to work, let's ride to school, did you ride today, ride, which is awesome. I think it's wonderful. Very, very wonderful. And one of the coolest things I saw this week was a 1945 video.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, 17 minutes. It's called How a Bicycle is Made. It's made by the British Council Films, and it's about the design and manufacture of Raleigh bikes in post-war England.
Hmm.
It's very interesting, the manufacturing process in those days. It's a wonderful video. It's on Vimeo. And if you have a pencil, we'll probably post this, but it's vimeo.com/39401575. It's really fascinating if you have 17 minutes and I think 34 seconds to watch. So that was cool.
Okay.
How are your National Bike Challenge miles doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. You know, you only get maximum points on that if you're commuting.
I know.
Your sport miles don't count as much.
Sport.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess that's a relative term, sport.
Well,
we ride because we want to ride.
Yeah, I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to encourage people to replace car trips with bike trips. So there's an incentive there in the point system to do commuting instead of just recreational riding. So that's fair.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I agree. I don't have a problem with that. Well, as of the last time I looked, there were 22,611 riders, 2,135 teams, and there have already been 1.332 million miles logged.
Whoa.
I think they're going to go way over the total that they wanted. So they're halfway to their goal of 50,000 riders.
Wow.
I know. I've logged a very meager amount of miles, not even worth talking about, because I just haven't had time to ride.
That'll change.
I know. Yeah, right. When I give up my day job, that would be awesome. I'd love to do that. So final numbers are in for Cyclophem, too, which was last Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. 147 rides, 14 countries.
Wow.
They're still tallying the actual number of people so that they could add up and say how many people. But I think that's pretty good for the short amount of time. I think she just announced it in March. So it was less than like 2.5 months. And boom. That was pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
You want to know about tonight's show?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
It's action-packed.
All right.
Yeah. So our first guest is Aaron Gully. And you're going to say, who is Aaron Gully? Well, he's the journalist of he is a journalist of the highest order. He's been editor of Outside Magazine and Velo News. He's written for such notable publications as Men's Journal, National Graphic Adventurer, Sport Diver, and more. He's a consummate reader and a keen observer. And his top 10 bike blogs, you might remember, catapulted Red Kite Prayer to the top of the bicycle blog heap. And he's with us this evening to talk about that and all the other cool things he gets to do as a journalist for these wonderful magazines. Pretty cool, huh?
Nice. Yeah.
Guess where we're going after that?
No idea.
Oh, yes, you do. Portland. We go to Portland all the time.
Okay.
This time we're going to talk with Ellie Thalheimer. Now, I've been waiting for her book. It's called Cycling Sojourner, A Guide to the Best Multi-Day Tours in Oregon. It came off the Action Press this past week, and it was worth waiting for. Ellie documents 8 tours that cover 1,800 miles, 40 days, 12 breweries, and 14 mountain passes. There are also 3 scenic bikeways. But it's more than just, you know, book of maps or one of those little, you know, well, turn here, go there, whatever. It's got some really interesting things about Oregon. She's got a lot of guest writers, and it's really a nice little book. very well done. I was very impressed. And then we're going to squeeze in a short segment with several of the Velocipede Salon dudes.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. We're going to talk with editor Josh Simons, our best friend, legendary Richard Sachs. Mike Zancanato will join us. And finally, one of the most popular East Coast builders, Mike Zancanato. You remember Mike?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. He's going to join us on a conference call to tell us about the Ballers Ride. Do you remember that from last year?
No.
It's like a three-day event for new builders. And it's really it's like a no-wussy event. Mm. If you're a wuss, you can't go. It's supposedly a weekend of road and cross riding. So that's what I got.
All right, let's get started.
Okay, let's say hello to Aaron Gully. He's out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Aaron, thank you for joining us this evening on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You have such a diverse and interesting background. Can you tell us a little about your upbringing, where you grew up, and how you came to journalism?
My parents were in agriculture and development work. They're sort of big proponents of education, and we lived in Nigeria for years. My dad and mom were over there sort of doing education about agriculture improvement and advancement. So that's kind of my early history, and I guess the way I came to journalism was I decided early on that I wanted to be in magazines and went to the University of Denver. They have a journalism program there. Came out here because I wanted to ride and to climb, as many college students do, and have moved into journalism since then.
Well, you've really been in the field a long time. So you did all this at the age of like 10, right?
It sounds yeah, like. Something like that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's true. I was pretty direct with what I wanted to do. I think I decided that at age 15 and went through college pretty quickly and went straight into magazines after that. So I actually had my first magazine job in San Francisco, I guess when I was 20. I was working at the Ziff Davis publications out there, Mac Weekly and PC Computing, and then went on to Wired Magazine after that, you know, basically as an intern. But so I guess I got into it pretty quickly.
Well, you have a very direct and precise style. I like it. It's easy to read what you write, and it's not dry. I mean, it has some life to it, so I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of dovetailing of journalism and cycling as we move towards some of these articles that first attracted me to hunting you down anyway. When did you actually start? You did all these sort of back journal kind of things. When did you start writing for adventure and sporting style publications?
Well, I did an internship while I was in college at Rock and Ice Magazine, which is a climbing publication. And then, like I said, I moved to San Francisco, and I was working sort of as a grunt with those computer titles. And I think at the time I was fact-checking a buyer's guide or something, and you know, you're checking how much RAM each computer has and how fast each processor is, and I was just thinking, oh my God, what have I signed up for? This is going to be the death of me if I have to keep doing this for the rest of my life. And about that time I got a call from Rock and Ice in Boulder, and they wanted me to come back out and work for the magazine. So that was sort of perfect timing, because I was having so many second thoughts about being at the computer places, and so I moved to Boulder and began writing for them, and sort of moved up the ranks, and actually got the editorship of that magazine pretty shortly thereafter.
Well, they actually paid you real money, which is even cooler.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't much, but I was excited to make a salary, be doing something fun, and be doing something about something that I cared about. You know, rock climbing at the time, I was a big rock climber, so being engaged in what we were writing about was especially helpful.
What kind of stories do you find most interesting? What compels you to pursue one thing and maybe not another?
Well, I think it sort of harkens back to my upbringing, having grown up overseas. I'm always drawn to stories that take me out of my life and take me into places that I don't otherwise know about and sort of make me realize how big the world is that we live in. I know that's a very sort of cliche thing to say, but I find it so fascinating to meet people that lead, and I guess how diverse and interesting lives people lead. I recently did a story about a year ago now about this island in South Korea called Jeju. We went out there to report a piece about these people called the Hanyao. Basically, they're women free divers. And, you know, it's got this long sort of history and tradition, and the women have been diving there, collecting abalone and collecting conch and urchin and seaweed for their living for, I guess it's been two centuries since this has sort of developed. In recent years with, education, what it is, and with much more opportunity, the tradition is dying out. So these women, now that are doing it are in their 50s and 60s and
wow.
70s and even 80s. We met a couple of women who were in their 80s who are still diving. And so we got to go out and dive with them. These ladies go out into the ocean, and I mean it's hardcore. It's like when we were there, it was 56 degrees, the water temperature. So it's really cold. They go out. They spend 6 hours a day harvesting. They swim a half mile to a mile offshore. They have these floaties with nets that they put their quarry in. So, they're diving down to, 20 feet, and then some of them dive down to as deep as 60, 65 feet. And they just do this all day long. So we were out diving with them, and we spent maybe an hour and a half out with them. I was freezing. So
yeah, no kidding.
Back in. And we just, I got a hot shower, felt much better, and I was waiting and waiting, and they were still out there. And finally, 6 hours goes by, and they come back in, and they've got these huge nets. I mean, hundreds of pounds of food. It takes like five or six of them to hoist them into the onto shore. And at the time I was back home, I was training for the Arizona Trail Race, which is a race that goes across southern Arizona. And I just looked at these ladies. They're all old enough to be my grandmother. And I just thought, God, this race in Arizona has such a reputation as being a hard thing, and I just thought, we're not hardcore at all. These ladies are so tough. It was just really impressive. So that's the type of thing, I like to see things like that and experience things that I don't otherwise get to see.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating one. You get to travel to all these really interesting places too, which is even more fun. So last fall, this is the thing that really sort of zoned in on you for me, and that was the publication of your top 10 cycling blogs in Outside Magazine. So you seem to be able to find time to do all this travel, write all these wonderful articles, and read all these blogs. Are there like more hours in your day than in ours?
I don't sleep a lot. I prefer I sleep more. I get up pretty early. I spend the first hour of my day going through all the news and blogs and everything that I like to do. There's training thrown in there, so yeah. I mean, I'm not one to waste the hours in a day for sure.
Yeah. So what makes a blog one of your favorites? The ones that you'll go back to over and over again. Which of course, Red Kite Prayer was your number one. So obviously, that one had some intrigue for you.
One thing I like in a blog, and Red Kite Prayer does this pretty well, is analysis versus, there's so many places these days where we can just read the race reports and get the gear information. But, for instance, John Wilcoxon did an interesting blog, I think it was earlier in the week, how he's talking about how kind of better science has led to kind of parity in pro cycling these days. Right now we're watching the Tour of California.
Yeah, the Amgen Tour.
Yeah, right. And right. We're watching the Giro, and you're seeing more people up there competing for the finish. And he was making the argument that because training has gotten so good, and because we're so sort of scientific about how we're preparing, That's why we're seeing so many more people being competitive in these races. And so that sort of analysis definitely appeals to me. And I also really like brevity. I guess that's by virtue of so much information. But for instance, I really like the Adventure Journal's Daily Bike.
Right.
It's a quick, succinct little hit. You know, it's 200 words or something. It usually got some history or it's got some personality. But it's something I can sort of digest really quickly, go look at it, learn something, and sort of move on to other things. And then the other thing that I like in a good blog is sort of utility, practicality. If there's information that I can actually use, like on Bike Hack a couple of weeks ago, had a quick fix for a torn sidewall. That stuff that at some point I'll be out on a ride and it'll come in handy.
I'd like to take one moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Aaron Gully. He's out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of my favorite places, and talking to us about what makes a good blog and why he's such a successful journalist, which you are. You write for some amazing publications. So let's talk a little bit about one of your more recent, although the top 10 blogs were recent, but about the bicycle-friendly bars. I thought that was kind of an interesting little article. Except for the cafe in Italy, where the most awesome thing on the menu looked like a cappuccino, which would have taken my heart away. It was a beautiful picture of a cappuccino, by the way. Latte art. I love it. Tell me about that. How do you find these top 10 in your mind? And they may, of course, not be the only 10, but you choose them for specific reasons.
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting point you make, actually. And I would go back to the blog story. I thought it was so funny. I got so much feedback, negative feedback on that story from people saying, oh, you didn't hit this one, or you didn't tell us about this one, or, you don't know anything about cycling because you didn't put Bike Snob New York City on. There were so many people that sort of were critical of it. And I think you make a good point. I mean, it's not that I don't necessarily know about these things, but two things. It's just an opinion when it comes down to it. I mean, it's my opinion, and it's the things that appeal to me for certain reasons. And secondly, we try to pick things that aren't so well known all the time. If we're just telling people about the top 10 blogs or the top 10 cafes that are out there that everybody knows about, it's not really a service to anybody.
Yeah, it's like preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
Nobody's getting any new information. And I totally agree. I thought that your choices were really interesting, and I never would have known about a lot of those things.
And I think that's the point, exactly.
Exactly. Well, that makes sense to me. That's very cool. So have you had feedback for getting from the people who always have to kvetch and moan about the establishments themselves or, like, the blog? What kind of... what happens to these people? They call it the Oprah effect. All of a sudden, boom, Patrick Brady's hits went nuts when you published that. I mean, he and I had a conversation about that, so I know what happened. So I would imagine the bars, do you hear back from those people? Do they let you know, like, wow, thanks, I think?
Definitely. I think that people don't realize quite how big Outside Magazine is. I mean, our readership is... 725,000 readers. So when we publish about something, it actually does have a sort of big effect. I'll give you a good example. A couple of years ago, we picked a small company and gave them Gear of the Year for their mountain bike. Their sales skyrocketed after that. They were so busy that they literally couldn't keep up with production.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, I think they said that their sales on that bike tripled that year alone. It makes a huge difference, and it's always sort of nice to hear back from these companies that people are paying attention to what we're doing.
Well, and so, there's the positive and negative on that it does wonders for the company as long as they're prepared.
Right. I mean, we actually try these days to make an effort to... give people the heads up and, you know, sometimes mitigate the choices we make if we think a company is sort of too small to deal with the volume that they're going to get.
Exactly. Well, at least you think about that, which I would appreciate, you know, having certain things going on in our bike shop, for example. There's no way we could take a hit on some of the things we do, like our custom fitting. You know, it's like, oh, my goodness, you can't tell 700,000 people that. Anyway, so you recently did, back in March, an article about the five best climbs in North America. How'd you come up with that one?
You know, I started thinking about that after a trip that I took to Hawaii last spring. I wasn't over there for riding, but we drove up Mount Haleakala, which is the big peak on the island, for work one morning. And we were driving up, and it's this big sort of sweeping highway that goes up. And it seemed like the grade never got really all that steep. And you're going up through all these climactic zones, and you need to go through rain, and then you go into the clouds, and then you come back out, and it's sunny. And I just thought, man, I've got to ride this thing. So I went down to town the next day and rented a bike, and I did the ride, and it was incredible. Like, where else do you get to ride from, you know, sea level up to 10,000 feet in one fell swoop and not take long doing it? So it just got me thinking about, you know, what other climbs are out there and what other climbs I should sort of travel to do. So that was the advent of the idea.
Well, and so you found a book. Somebody else wrote a book. I can't remember his name right now.
John Plumerson.
Yeah. That
called Complete Guide to Climbing by Bike.
So he mentioned, I know, Mount Mitchell, and a lot of our customers over the years have done the quote-unquote assault on Mount Mitchell, and we have some who are doing Mount Evans. So the five that you chose, how did you choose those five?
It was basically an interview with him, and he and I went through and sort of talked about what were sort of great iconic climbs in this country. You know, what climbs could merit traveling to, and, you know, had great views, and you know, you would put in enough time to merit a trip to ride them. So it was a lot of feedback from him.
Okay. Well, I just thought that was interesting. I would never do a lot of that. I'm scared of those kind of altitudes. I'm afraid I just couldn't breathe. But whatever. Anyway, so I also want to ask you about if you could report on anything in the bicycle world right now, what would it be?
You know, what I'm trying to get the magazine interested in writing about is why bikes are so expensive these days. I remember when I bought my first mountain bike, I don't know, it's been 25 years ago. I don't know if it can have been that long, but anyway, it's a long time ago. I bought a really nice bike. I bought it on sale, but a top-end bike at that time was costing, what, like $3,000 or something?
Yes, and in 1997, you could buy a full Waterford custom geometry bike with full Dura-Ace for $3,500.
Exactly.
I know,
and
exactly.
And you know, now you're looking at a specialized McLaren Venge for $18,000. I mean, I know that there's a lot of engineering that's gone into it. I know there's a lot of development in technology, but still, to me, it seems like it's a little bit off the charts how the prices have gone. So I'd really like to write a story about that.
And I would love to be in on that one, because from our perspective, we feel you're absolutely right. You can buy the best custom bicycle probably in the world for under $8,000. Why would you buy something that isn't custom for $18,000? Anyway, do you have any future articles in the works that you can talk about right now, besides the one you'd like to do?
I'm working on a story about this new event in France. It's in its second year, called the Haute Route Cycliste Sportive. It's a 7-day amateur stage race that covers, I think, 780 kilometers and 21,000 meters of climbing. You know, it goes over some of the most famous of the cols from the Tour de France, the Madeleine, the Glandon, Issoire. So it's appealing to me as a cyclist to be able to go do this thing. But the story is sort of also about how ridiculous it is in a way. You know, we know these things are going to be so hard, and you have to sort of train for months and months to get fit for them, and it's going to hurt when you go do it. So it's kind of a comical take on what makes us as cyclists and athletes go over and kind of take on these types of
challenges. When is that event?
It's in August, so I better get training.
So you're actually going to do it? Can't you just take a motorcycle and follow along? That's just a joke. I guess you need to do it, huh?
Actually, they offered that you could sort of just ride along, but that wouldn't make for a very good copy, would it?
No, not really. That would be like phonying it up. You can't do that.
Exactly.
Well, gosh, this has been so nice. It was good to catch up with you finally and learn more about you and how Outside, sort of, which is the publication we've really been talking about. You write for a lot of other publications. You don't just do Outside Magazine. But you seem to do a lot of work with them.
I do primarily the cycling work that I do these days is for Outside Magazine.
Yeah. Which is very nice that they cover cycling as well as they do. Because
I think it's worth saying. I think it's something people don't realize about Outside Magazine. I mean, they're very serious about their bike coverage. And, for our review process, we bring in hundreds of bikes a year, and we take a huge trip down to Tucson with, probably 80 bikes. We spend a week down there riding all the bikes with, 20 testers a day. I mean, they're very sort of committed to their bike coverage, which is nice for me because it's sort of authentic.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Aaron, this is just really cool. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me this evening.
I appreciate you calling me.
Oh, it is my pleasure.
Great.
All right. Thanks so much. Have a good night.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Aaron Gully joined us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he is a journalist and writes for a number of publications, including Outside Magazine.
Yes, he does. He does mostly cycling stuff for Outside, evidently.
And he walks the talk as well as writing the words.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
I thought that story about the women divers was interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Freediving is radical.
You think? It's like free anything, falling off cliffs, whatever, in those kind of squirrel suits. Those always freak me out. But it's what's really cool about Aaron is he does everything.
Mm-hmm.
He's really a cool guy.
Okay.
Should we take a break?
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we've got another guest, and then we've got a whole group of guests. I don't know what you call a group of frame builders.
A gaggle.
That's a gaggle of geese.
Yeah, but in this case, it could be close.
It could be close.
You never know.
Well, I'll go see if I can find out what the official term for a large group of frame builders is.
Oh, good. I can't wait to hear what you come up with for that.
All right. We will bring you all that and more right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Starting Friday, May 25th, and running through Sunday, May 27th, you can attend the Eleanor Squire Library Spring Book Sale at the Cleveland Botanical Garden in University Circle. Browse gardening books as well as children's history, art, sciences, and fiction, plus rare and first editions, prints, movies, and CDs. Access to the sale requires museum admission. All proceeds will benefit the nonprofit Cleveland Botanical Garden. More information by calling 216-707-2812.
I'm Greg Priddy, and right across the table from me is
Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. During that short break, we decided that a large group of frame builders is indeed a salon.
Velocipede salon?
Perhaps. But I think you could just say it's a salon of frame builders.
A salon of frame builders. Well, it could also be a saloon.
Well, depending on the frame builders, yes, it could. Yes, it could.
Yes, indeed. Shall we move on?
Yes, let's move
along.
Okay. Where are we going next?
We're going to Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And we are going to talk with Ellie Thalheimer. She is the author of a wonderful new book called The Cycling Sojourner, A Guide to the Best Multi-Day Tours in Oregon. So here we go. Ellie, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Well, our mutual friend, Ellie Blue, told me about this amazing woman who was writing a book about bicycling in Oregon. And sure enough, it showed up last week.
Good.
Yeah, and Ellie was right. It's a wonderful resource. Could you tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and how you got to be such a cycling aficionado?
I started bicycling when I was a teenager. My dad actually brought me, I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he brought me out to the woods. And from there, I just mountain biked a bunch. And then when I got up to Portland for college, I started using my mountain bike on the streets all the time. And there was so much awesome bicycling infrastructure that I just began to bicycle everywhere. And that evolved into eventually cycle touring with him down the coast from Astoria, Oregon to San Francisco, California. And that was both of our first tours, and that's where I fell in love with bicycle touring. And since then, over the last decade, I've led bicycle tours. I have coordinated routes for bicycle touring companies. I worked for Lonely Planet for a number of years, and while I was there, I authored their book, Cycling Italy, a cycling guidebook to Italy. And eventually, through various channels and means, I came to writing Cycling Sojourner, a guide to the best multi-day tours in Oregon.
Yeah, well, you don't seem to be old enough to do all that, but we'll let that pass for now. It is a really nice little book. I like it.
Thank you.
I like the size of it and some of the other things. So we'll talk about this. So where'd you go to school? At University of Portland or at Reed?
Lewis and Clark.
Oh, Lewis and Clark. Very nice. And so was your education in journalism?
No, I did major in English.
Okay.
And also I had a minor in Latin American studies.
Aha. Uh-huh. So the ride that you did with your dad from Astoria to San Francisco, is that the STP ride?
No, that's actually Seattle.
Oh, you're right.
Seattle,
of course.
Portland.
Yeah. You're right.
And that's the Astoria, Oregon, is at the very northernmost point of the Oregon coast.
Okay.
And then so we cycle all the Oregon coast, and then all of the California coast to San Francisco.
How long did that take?
Oh, we did it. We weren't especially vigorous, and we did it in 2.5 weeks.
Nice.
We had a rest day about every fourth day.
Wow. So when did you decide that you needed to start working on and writing Cycling Sojourner?
So funny enough, over the last decade, I've also gotten into a couple of other different kinds of cycling, and my husband got me interested in doing endurance gravel road racing, and I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
In the Midwest.
No.
And there's a 206-mile gravel road race in Kansas called the Dirty Kanza, and I was training for it. And I, instead of the grueling training process that training for a race like that requires, I wanted to go bicycle touring, one of my favorite things to do. So I tried to look up information about tours in and around Portland, and I couldn't find any information, which was kind of mind-boggling to me. So I spent tons of time creating these tours that left Portland, looping around back to Portland, so we could have some really long training rides. And at the end of it, I was just kind of perplexed, and I wanted to see if I could somehow fill this hole, and started looking into it and figuring out what the publishing scenario was. And I realized that this kind of guidebook isn't really that sexy to publishing companies because the margins aren't very good. They're very costly to produce, and the payback isn't huge motivation. So there's not a lot of stuff out there, and not a lot of really great information on the internet either. There's day rides and stuff about day rides and areas, but
right.
Nothing with all of the touring information that you need, like lodging and camping and resources along the way, road conditions, all of that different stuff that I spent tons of time looking up for the individual tours that we did.
It's very obvious in the outcome that you spend a lot of attention to the details of what it would look like and what it would consist of and the different places that you go. And you make it fun to read. You actually point out really interesting things along the way. So I was just paging through one of the tours and the map, you know, the cue sheet, you know, turn here, go there, this many miles. At one point it said cute house. And I thought that's really cool, but only a woman would have thought of that. That's pretty cool. I like it. I also,
I approach the guidebook as with complete bias. So I just, as a longtime cycle tourist, I wanted to tell my readers what I think is awesome. So, and I didn't really care about what normal guidebooks have done. I just wanted to do what I think is the ultimate best thing.
Well,
how to create the best tour possible. So
it came out
well.
That's
how I approached it. Thank you very much. You have lots of kind words. I appreciate it.
Well, and you don't do all the writing. You have actually a few other people who sort of jumped in and helped you with it. How did you find those people to give you their take on certain aspects of the book?
I think you're talking about the local wisdom sections.
Yes.
So in each chapter, there's either, you know, a paragraph or a page that someone from that community, wherever the area is that I'm covering, gives the lowdown on what they think about the cycling. Or, for instance, in the wine country, I got a very bike-crazy winery owner to talk about how to actually taste wine. So a very brief kind of overview of how to taste wine, and that was the local wisdom section. So they just kind of came to me. And it wasn't that hard because there's so many people who are great resources in Oregon. It kind of came really naturally. Just friends and friends of friends or suggestions, and it was really one of my favorite parts because I think that it's a really important aspect of the book to bring those voices of Oregon actually to represent.
And I agree with you. I think that's a very good idea. And I just, you know, again, the book is really light and easy to, I don't mean lightweight wise, but I mean it's light reading. It's not like you have to slog through it to figure anything out. It's pretty interesting. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ellie Thalheimer, and she wrote a fabulous book. It is called The Cycling Sojourner, A Guide to the Best Multi-Day Tours in Oregon. And it pretty much covers the whole state, you know, little areas here and there all over the state, which is very cool, too. So what happens when roads change or when routes change? You have 8 basic tours in this book, right?
Yes, and a bonus one that will be out soon online.
Oh, very cool. That's something I didn't know.
Yeah, it's a 2-day tour from Portland, and it's a free bonus ride.
Nice. So if you...
Yeah.
That's very cool. So what's the longest route in the book?
It's 7 days.
Aha. Uh-huh. How many miles?
Oh, I don't remember exactly how many miles
okay.
it is.
Oh, okay.
So...
Is the 2-day route going to be the shortest one, the new one that's going to come out online?
It is, yes, it is definitely the shortest.
Do you have a favorite ride?
It's hard to answer that because it depends what I'm going for. If I'm going for a super easy jaunt out of the city and say it's my anniversary, then I would go to the wine country.
Sure.
Right outside of Portland. But if I have to say that I have a special love in my heart for Eastern Oregon.
Okay.
Just because it's so unexplored. I mean, there's still tourist infrastructure and people, cycle tourists definitely go there, but it's just a really genuine experience and world-class cycling.
So what kind
I
of...
I love the people out there.
On the eastern side of the state? And it's less populated. It's a much more rural area, it looks like.
Yeah, Harney County, where my most rural and remote ride is, and partially gravel ride, is in Harney County. I think has 1,700 people.
Oh my goodness!
It's pretty large. It's a pretty large county.
That's kind of interesting. Very isolated. It sounds like.
Yes.
So, what kind of bike do you use?
I have a number of bikes.
Of course you do. That was okay. I got it.
So If I'm going for a lighter tour, like I'm not carrying camping gear, then I go on, I had my one bike for a really long time. It's called a Sofa King. It was made in by my dad's bike shop in Little Rock, Arkansas, or it's commissioned through them. It's very kind of niche custom bike. And now to replace that, my husband, for a wedding present, gave me a Pereira, which is a bike made by Pereira Cycles in Portland, Oregon.
But nice.
So that's a pretty nice bike.
So your dad owns a bike shop, huh?
Yeah, he does. So at the very beginning, he took me mountain biking, and then he loved cycling so much that he actually became the business brains behind our local bike shop.
Very cool.
Yeah. I have to also say that my heftier bike is a Cannondale, too.
Okay.
So I don't just bike on those bikes. I also have the heftier kind of like to carry the huge loads.
Sure, sure. So where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
They can go to my website, cyclingsojourner.com.
Okay.
And there's a link to pay for a book there.
Okay.
And if they prefer to, there's also Amazon. Just going to Amazon.com or to Powell's Books website. You can also buy it there.
Powell is just one of those iconic bookstores. Pretty crazy place. I've been there.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome, and it's very Oregon.
It is very Oregon. I think Oregon is modeled after Powell Books. They've been around forever. Well, you know, I don't know when and if I'm ever going to be able to take one of your tours, but I would say that this is going to be a really good resource for people who want to learn more about Oregon in a very organized and yet sort of not real structured way. You just go and you just do it and have some fun.
Thank you very much. And when you do come out here, my next book, Hop in the Saddle, A Guide to Portland's Craft Beer Scene by Bike, will be out.
Okay.
And you can, when you fly into Portland, you can make sure to go on a bike and beer tour from that guidebook.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, too, and we'll check back on that. Well, Ellie, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening. Good luck with your book. I know it's just out. Sell lots of copies.
I appreciate you having me on the show.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ellie Thalheimer joined us from Portland, Oregon. She's written quite a book. I was leafing through it while you were speaking with her.
Isn't it nice?
Yeah.
I like it.
It smells good, too.
It's really... It smells good.
It does. It's got that
new book smell. Yeah, that's like your new car smell, only it's a new book smell.
Must be soy ink or something.
Well, I don't know, but obviously she lives in Portland. Come on.
Probably.
It must be.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a really nicely well done, very nicely well done book.
Indeed it is.
Yeah. It's got... She's thought of a lot of interesting things to include in it that you don't usually see in books like this. You know, she talks about not just lodging and where to eat, but just really cool stuff, cost options, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, you can find a place to camp. You can also find a place to stay at a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she includes basically for everything you'd want to do, extracurricular activities on a ride. I mean, why not?
Very complete.
It's complete.
Yeah.
The complete.
Well, speaking of complete.
We should complete the show.
Well, and these next guys, they're complete something. I'm not sure what they are.
They're the salon.
They're a complete salon.
They are a complete salon. A triad.
Yes.
We welcome Richard Sachs, Too Tall Josh Simons, and Mike Zancanato to the Outspoken Cyclist. Again, all three of them have been on the show. All three of you are welcome again. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Diane.
Hey. Hi, Diane.
Hi. So let's start by identifying everybody. Josh, tell us who and what.
Josh Simons, also known as Too Tall on Velocipede Salon. You know me from the previous radio show and from my websites for coaching and for the Velocipede Salon.
I do indeed. And go ahead. Everybody knows you, Richard, but go ahead. Speak up.
Hi, Diane. It's Richard Sachs. On the internet, my name is E. Ritchie, and I'm a frame builder, and you know me from our daily emails.
I do indeed.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Thanks for having us.
Mike?
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
My name is Mike Zancanato. Yep. We had our previous interview, owner of Zancanato Bicycles, and I guess since we're all doing the username online, everybody knows me as Zank, so...
Well, this call is about an event that you guys do, and I know that this is, I think, the second year. Is that right?
That's right, Diane.
Okay, and this year it's May 25th and 27th. So let's start with, what is the Baller's Ride?
The Baller's Ride is a natural growth of the riding that that Mike, myself, and some friends have been doing over the years. We've been riding buddies and really enjoyed mixed terrain riding very much. It seems to be some of the most rewarding stuff there is. I think all of us appreciate the things that bicycles can do when they're really pushed. And we all dig bikes that can sort of do it all, hard pack, asphalt, technical stuff and whatnot. And it's really not a get-together until someone's hurt.
So, how pleasant.
So, as you know, I create these events, and it came to me that I should host the Baller's Ride. And baller is a slang term for a rich basketball player who's made it, but we've adopted it. So Baller's Ride is about an 80-mile-long ride. It's very hard. I make absolutely no excuses. It's pretty much by invite only. And the day is followed by some talks from the frame builders about what they do and what they're about. It's extremely casual. There's no placards. There's no awards. And we just kind of hang out and talk and bond. But that's what it's about. I feel sorry for these guys sometimes because they have to, you know, go to these big shows and spend a lot of money, and they have to stand behind a desk all day long, and they don't get to talk about what kind of flux they use or who's got what lugs or who's doing what or how did you do that.
Who gets invited to the ride?
Small builders and some friends who are not builders. Guys who I know can ride bikes. I don't make, like I say, I really don't make any excuses or... And I'm not taking money in order to just have people there. I want guys there who can really ride their bikes, love to ride, who won't whine if they taco their wheels and bend their frames or something stupid during the ride. They're just going to laugh it off and find a way home.
So how many people will come to the ride this year, do you think?
I think I've got about 32 people.
Wow. All right. Yeah. So, Richard, what do you bring to this ride?
Well, you know... myself, the experience of having, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years worth of riding with, you know, the nucleus of guys that make up this group that, you know, is part of the Ballers, Josh and Zank and, you know, Darren and a few other people from the Velocipede Salon. You know, the concept of Ballers may be kind of on the new side, but the riding that we've been doing that is similar to it is it goes back. So, you know, we all live, you know, so far away from each other that it's a shame, but getting together several times a year, or in this case for Ballers, you know, next weekend, is a way for us to, you know, bond. And, you know, the side agenda for the Ballers is also for the frame builders who are going to be there to meet people who are interested in their work, to talk about it, and to do it in a real-world environment rather than an antiseptic you know, show hall or in a, you know, local bike shop or on the internet. This is basically, it's not far from being Outward Bound and a Navy SEALs training camp for riders and frame builders and people that just, you know, love the pain, but by 4 o'clock can't even remember what they did that day because they're, you know, thinking about happy hour and the barbecue. I mean, it's fun. It's the kind of thing where, you know, the last, you know, 2 or 3% of the ride, you think, I'll never do this again. And then, like, 2 hours later, you can't wait for next year.
Well, Mike, what do you bring to the party?
I bring the course tape and the hurdles for the Sunday cyclocross extravaganza that we have. Josh kind of forgot to mention that Sunday is all about cross. And last year, we set up a pretty fun course, and we did a little clinic for some of the newer riders who may not have ever raced cyclocross or maybe not even really familiar with what it is. So we did a clinic in the morning, and then we did hot laps on the course, and we're kind of expanding the format this year. So we're going to have, it's actually going to be a live event. We have it on Bike Ridge, actually, for folks to come participate, and we have a few different heat formats. So really what, you know, we want to mix it up and show that these bikes can not only tackle an 80-mile super hard dirt road ride, but also you can race cross on them and pretty much, you know, one bike for everything. So
this is a showcase for some of these bikes too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Aha.
Yeah,
interesting. Absolutely. Well, yep. So how many events over the, so it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's May 25th, 26th, 27th. How does the weekend go? So what is the progress of the weekend?
Friday, everybody arrives, usually around 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock or when I have critical mass. Just go out for a quick leg opener road ride, just a 30, 35-mile thing. Then Saturday at 9 a.m., I have a sign-in, and everyone, you know, gets their name on this big piece of paper, and they do a rollout. Nobody's allowed to pass me for about the first hour, or there'll be a beat down, and we ride the hills together until we get to the dirt. And once we get to the dirt, everybody goes for it. And we will all get back there, you know, probably, you know, maybe 2:30 or so. We're going to do some open mic talks, you know, with some of the guys. Galzetti is going to talk. Who else is going to talk? Craig Ryan, Tim O'Donnell, might have a mystery guest, not saying, you know. Might
just not saying, huh?
New Hampshire, I don't know.
Okay.
And I'll try to take some live questions from Velocipede Salon at that time. I'll have the computer up and get guys to throw some questions at them. Saturday night, everyone's going to bro down and have a bunch of beers. Then Sunday morning, for those who are conscious, I'm asking the small builders who didn't talk before to get together over coffee and stand around with their frames and with some of the folks who are not frame builders, and just give a very informal talk. Guys like Wade Patton, who don't, you know, make but a frame or two a year. Noah Rosen, who, you know, he paints. Maybe Tom Palermo. I'm not sure if he's coming or not. He's a local builder, small. Jeff Buchanan, that sort of thing. And then after that, cyclocross racing. We got Mickey from Spooky Bikes. He will be there, by golly. He's a wonderful, wonderful teacher, and he's going to give a clinic. And then we're going to have hot lap time trials at about 11 o'clock. And then we're going to do frame builder and rider cross relay races. So we pair up a frame builder with several other riders who are not frame builders. And then we're going to do a full-on cyclocross race on Mike's awesome course. And after that, the last thing will be a frame builder talk with Mike Zancanato and John Green from Florida, who are going to talk about just the concepts of design, and they're going to take all questions. They're kind of awesome about that.
Do you see that maybe a baller's ride could happen on the West Coast and maybe in the Midwest and in the South? Can you expand on the concept and not necessarily just keep it all to yourselves? It's just a question.
Yeah. Good question. The real possibility that next year it's going to be over on the West Coast, and you bring up something that I wasn't sure I was going to talk about today, and that is the give back. I don't want the cost to attend this event to ever stop someone from coming, and it may be that what I need to do is to have more riders and generate some income from them so that I can give back to the frame builders.
Richard, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's a seed that's planted. You know, I really think that the seed was planted years ago when we all started getting together socially or on the Internet as kind of a group of pals. And then the writing that we started doing turned into, you know, the Ballers thing. I mean, Josh had been running training camps all along from his coaching business anyway, so he had the experience of herding riders to Nelson County, Virginia, to begin with. But the Ballers thing is kind of a standalone thing. And I really think it's a good way to somehow integrate, you know, some independent frame builders, not the entire community, but some who want to be part of this, and those who do want to be part of it really have to be riders, because this is not a commercial weekend. It might be like in sideways a commercial weekend, but it's a way to, you know, show your mettle, you know, spelled both ways, and,
right.
You know, have a good time, and, you know, maybe plant a seed, you know, as an independent frame builder with some people who are there. And if not, you'll have the memories. It's not overtly commercial in that respect, but I do think that it's a good platform to build on, so that in several years, you know, there might be like, I don't know, 10 frame builders and maybe 40 guests or some ratio that works for Josh.
Josh and Richard and Mike, I'm going to sort of be getting back at you to hear how the Ballers ride went after next weekend. I think it's got a very interesting potential to it. So I'd like to see how it's going to pan out. You guys try to stay safe, please, for those 3 days, you know. No crashes, no broken anything. You guys are all, except for Mike, you guys are getting a little old for this stuff, you know.
What?
Yeah, well, whatever.
I gotta go.
All right, well, have fun next weekend. Thank you for joining
me.
All righty. Bye-bye, everybody.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Richard Sachs, Mike Zancanato, and Josh Simons joined us from, undisclosed locations on the East Coast.
Because they're undercover.
The Frame Builder Witness Protection Program forbids us from telling you exactly where they were. But they're gearing up for what sounds like a really interesting weekend.
It sounds like a crazy weekend to me. I can understand. Women. You know what? Women aren't this nuts. Usually.
Some of them are.
Yeah, usually. Well, that's true. That's true. There have been some pretty nutso women who ride mountain bikes, but we won't go into that.
Are there women building frames?
There are
days?
A few.
Okay.
There are a few. There are, of course, there are a couple in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? It's interesting, though. They keep a fairly low profile, which mm-hmm. is, and they do nice work.
Mm-hmm.
They do nice work. And normally, I think this is true, and if I am wrong, I apologize, but I think they mostly build frames for women.
Well, it would make some sense.
It
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
It does. But I think the Ballers ride sounds like a crazy weekend. But Josh really wanted to talk about it, and I really wanted to hear about it.
Well, and so we did.
Exactly.
Okay, then. We've got to scoot out of here.
Probably.
But thanks for joining us, and we'll be back at you next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.